Just going to run this dog to see if we can find any type of human remains that are left.
Listen to Where Secrets Go to Die, The Disappearance of Derek Hennigan. From the Detroit Free Press, a new podcast set in the woods of Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Available on Apple, Spotify, Freep.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The fossil record of planet Earth tells us that there have been five mass extinctions, the most famous being the fifth that destroyed the dinosaurs. This week's guest warns that we're in the midst now of the sixth extinction, and its cause is human activity. She's Elizabeth Colbert, this week on Story in the Public Square. And welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. Alongside me is my friend and co-host, G. Wayne Miller of the Providence Journal. Story in the Public Square is an effort to study, celebrate, and tell stories that matter. To do that, we sit down every week with the best storytellers around, authors, scholars, filmmakers, and journalists, really anyone using or studying narrative to explain the world in which we live. This week, we're joined by science journalist and Pulitzer Prize winner Elizabeth Colbert, who last night became the 2019 recipient of the Pell Center Prize for Story in the Public Square. Betsy, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Congratulations on all of your success.
Thank you.
We've marveled at your work for a long time, and from the New York Times to the New Yorker, and now your success in books. When did you know that you wanted to be a writer?
Well, that's an interesting question. I'm not sure I ever knew it. I got a Fulbright to go study German literature. I studied German literature in college, and I got a Fulbright to continue studying German literature. And I went to Germany, and I decided pretty quickly I wasn't going to study German literature. And I used that year to, I became a stringer, basically. And I wrote a bunch of little stories, travel stories, and I got hooked by the, and I also did work. So, you know, Newsweek or the Times would have a correspondent in Germany, but he or she couldn't cover everything, so you'd get sent out to just feed notes to someone. And I found it really fun and exciting, and when you're a journalist, you are always doing something new, every day was something new, and I sort of got bitten by the journalism bug.
And when did the journalism bug turn into science journalism?
Well, not for quite a while. I went to the New York Times. That's where I actually, after I came back from Germany, I got a very low-level job at the New York Times. It was called being a copy person, which is just a kind of gender-neutral version of copy boy. And that term came from the days when you would type a story. You know, the reporters would sit down and type a story on a sheaf of carbon paper, and you would rip the sheaf of carbon paper out of the typewriter and yell copy, and the copy boy would come and break this sheaf of, I think there were six or eight, eight-part book, it was called, and then they would go to layout, and it would go to the editors, and everyone would get one of these copies, and then you'd do another sheaf, and it would, so that's, if you've ever heard it in an old movie, you know, slug it, slay, and write it, and do it in takes. This is one take. Anyway, so it was a very antiquated term when I got there, the copy people were not working with actual copy because there was no more physical copy. It was computerized, just the beginning of computerization. And I covered politics. I got sent to Albany. Once again, you just got sent somewhere. I got sent to Albany. I ended up covering local politics, New York State and city politics for quite a long time. And then eventually I was hired by The New Yorker in 1999, and I was supposed to write a political column, a column called Around City Hall, which had been written by a woman named Andy Logan for a long time. And everyone thought Andy was a man, but Andy was actually a woman. And from there, I, through another circuitous path, sort of wended my way towards environmental writing, really more environmental writing than science writing, and that sort of took over my writing life.
Was there something in particular about covering the environment that spoke to you?
Well, I've always been, you know, interested / concerned about environmental issues since I was a kid and tried to, you know, organize a recycling program in my high school cafeteria. So it was definitely a theme. Even when I covered politics, I probably wrote more about environmental policy decisions than most, you know, people who were writing about Albany. And then when I got to The New Yorker, it happened to be right around the time that of the 2000 election, George W. Bush withdrew the U.S. from the Kyoto Protocol in 2001. And I was, once again, interested / concerned what is going on. At that time, it was possible to be a pretty well-informed person and not really know what to make of climate change. And I very naively thought, well, I'm going to write this story that's going to explain it all to everyone. The New Yorker has a long tradition of environmental journalism, going back to, you know, Silent Spring, which was first published in The New Yorker. I thought, well, I'll try to, you know, use the sort of power of the publication to sort of set this issue to rest once and for all. Is this something we really have to be worried about or not? And that journey, as I say, which took me to the Arctic several times and all around the world, began this writing about the environment.
So tell us about Field Notes from a Catastrophe, Man, Nature, and Climate Change. That was published in 2006. So 13 years ago, a different time. What went into the book and what were your conclusions?
Well, that book was really, that arose from a three-part series I wrote in The New Yorker, which I started in exactly like 15 years ago today, and in 2004, and it took a year to report the series. It appeared in 2005, and then it became a book in 2006. And that was written out of this impulse to sort of, you know, put this issue to rest. Lo and behold, it has not put this issue to rest. And it was a moment, interestingly, in time where a lot of the big scientific organizations in the U.S. were just coming out with their statements. I mean, climate change has been, you know, disputed in unscientific and ill-motivated and politically motivated way. But it was also there was a kind of a tension between the climate modelers who very early on, starting from the very earliest climate models in the 60s and 70s, foresaw very accurately, remarkably accurately, what adding a lot of carbon dioxide was going to do to the atmosphere.
By burning fossil fuels.
Yes, exactly. We're going to burn a lot of fossil fuels. We were dumping a lot of CO2 into the air. And that was going to change the temperature of the Earth, which we can go into the geophysics of that or not, as you desire. But they modeled that, and as I say, very, very accurately from the beginning, because it's a, you know, fairly simple geophysics, actually, although many, many complicated, you know, details. And then, but the guys on the ground, the field scientists who were out in the Arctic and all around the world who had data sets said, well, we're, you know, in the 60s and 70s, these were not warm decades. They were actually fairly cool decades, and there are explanations for that too. But then people, so the people on the ground were saying, well, you know, maybe the world is going to warm, but we're not seeing that yet. And then there were actually predictions made by, among others, Jim Hansen, who headed the NASA's climate arm for a long time, that the signal of climate change would begin to emerge from the noise around the year 2000. And that is exactly what happened. And that was right at the point that I was reporting this story. So big groups were coming out and saying, okay, we are seeing a clear climate change signal now. And I ended up going and spending a lot of time in the Arctic because that is actually where the signal is strongest, was strongest, and to a certain extent still is strongest. And that is owing to an effect, once again, predicted very early on, called the Arctic amplification. So you see that the world has warmed most dramatically in the Arctic.
Were these findings being communicated to the public, in other words, outside of the scientific community? Was the average person, reader, viewer privy to this?
They were probably privy to this if they wanted to be, but they certainly weren't. It certainly wasn't competing, you know, with a lot of other. This was sort of, you know, post, you know, the U.S. was going into Iraq. There was a lot of, you know, news yeah. going on. Let's put it that way. So I don't think it was top of mind for people. But you know, if you wanted to know, for example, you know, the American Geophysical Union came out in 2003 with a statement saying, you know, climate change is real. It's a serious problem. You know, how many people, you know, how was that covered? Probably pretty minimally.
But some people were paying attention.
Yeah. To this. Oh, absolutely.
And some of the people paying attention to this would be, I guess, I hate even to use the term, but climate deniers. Who were saying this, were saying what? This is a hoax, it's a liberal scientist, and blah, blah, blah. That was happening.
Yes, absolutely. There was a sort of a chorus of people, and now there's been a lot of, you know, subsequent to, you know, my research, which really didn't go into the whole denier, you know, industry, you know, denial industrial complex, whatever you want to call it. There's been a lot of great work by a group called Inside Climate by the LA Times, you know, some people have won Pulitzer Prizes, looking at how this concerted disinformation campaign was financed and, you know, propagated very much along the lines of the disinformation campaign that the tobacco industry fostered to try to confuse, just cloud the link between smoking and lung cancer. That also put off regulation of, you know, tobacco products for quite a long time, and we're seeing exactly, you know, the same dynamic play out.
Does that disinformation campaign explain why, from a public policy perspective, at the federal level, we have just not been able to break through?
Well, I think it's a very, very serious part of the problem. I'm not sure it's the only problem, because I do feel the disinformation campaign is finally failing and flagging as people see the effects of climate change pretty dramatically in different parts of this country for themselves. But I think it has two parts. Yes, one is the disinformation campaign, but two is it is a very difficult policy problem, as I needn't tell you. It's, you know, fossil fuels are at the base of our economy, everything we do, you know, here today, we're just sitting here, you know, with the lights on and the cameras rolling, and we all probably drove here. And, you know, so every aspect of modern life is tied up with fossil fuels. And to break that relationship is a monumental effort that we ought to be making. I couldn't, you know, argue more strongly for that. But it's not like, oh, if everyone just suddenly agreed we had a problem, that we would immediately have a solution.
We need to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. Every weekend, you can hear us at four different broadcast times on Sirius XM Satellite Radio's popular Politics of the United States. That's the POTUS channel, number 124. We produce this program with a great team of professionals at Rhode Island PBS, and we're lucky to work with them. I'm Jim Lutis. In my day job, I run the Pell Center for International Relations and Public Policy at Salve Regina University in beautiful Newport, Rhode Island. If you want to connect with me on Twitter, I'm at JM Lutis. Joining me, as always, is my friend and co-host, G. Wayne Miller, who is the author of 17 books and an award-winning journalist with the Providence Journal. You can connect with Wayne on Twitter, too, at G. Wayne Miller, all one word. And our guest this week is an accomplished environmental journalist, a staff writer at The New Yorker, and a Pulitzer Prize winner for her book, The Sixth Extinction. She's also the 2019 recipient of the Pell Center Prize for Story in the Public Square. She's Elizabeth Colbert, and she's on Twitter, too, at ELIZKOLBERT. What happens if we don't act?
Well, we're going to... what happens? And there are all sorts of, you know, if we really don't act, if we allow carbon emissions to rise in the at the rate that they're rising right now, and we just keep, one point I have to make is that this problem is cumulative. So it's not like a lot of other environmental problems or pollution problems where if you stop polluting, it dissipates. Carbon dioxide stays up in the air for a long time. So what we have put up there since the start of the Industrial Revolution is effectively, most of it's still up there. It's going to be up there, you know, for all intents and purposes for, you know, centuries. And so you can't, you can't roll back that clock. And if we keep adding and adding and adding, then the world at the end of the day is going to, you know, get warmer and warmer and warmer. And there's a time lag in the system, too. And I also have to emphasize that we have not yet seen the warming from the greenhouse gases we've already put up in the atmosphere. So if you say, well, I don't like the climate, you know, today, and when I decide I don't like it, you know, we're just going to stop. There's already a lot of inertia in the system. Climate scientists talk about warming that's still in the pipeline. So there's still more warming in the pipeline. And the more we put up there, the warmer it gets. The warmer it gets, the more we have to worry about sea levels rising, the more we have to worry about drought, the more we have to worry about flooding. All of these climate-related, you know, disasters that we are, as I say, seeing fire outbreaks, just ratchet them up that much more.
And the effect on populations varies by the part of the globe where you live. A wealthy country like the United States will be able to take measures that less wealthy countries, other parts of the world, will not. You're talking about sea level rise. For example, New York City, a wealthy city, will probably be able to do something to keep water from flooding Manhattan. Well, that is not the case, yeah, though, in parts of India and parts of many parts of the world. And that creates a whole second set of problems, which is people moving. Got to get out of here.
Yeah.
Got to get out of here.
Absolutely. But I do want to push back a little bit on the notion that, you know, oh, if you have a lot of money, you're going to be able to solve these problems, because I don't necessarily think that's true. There are a lot of unanticipated, you know, there are the known, you know, known knowns, the unknown.
Very
unknown.
Rumspelman, right?
Exactly.
Known knowns,
exactly.
The known unknowns, and the unknown
exactly.
unknowns.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, between the known unknowns and the unknown unknowns, you know, who knows? But just to take a city like Miami, which is built on limestone, which is very porous. So no one has come up with a way to keep the water out of Miami. You put up a seawall, you know, outside Miami, the water just comes underneath it. So, you know, the only thing anyone can think of is just, you know, putting everything on stilts, or I don't really know how they're going to. So the notion that we're just going to sort of, you know, spend our way out of this, I don't think that that is actually tenable. And when you think about all these things happening at once, so, you know, there's drought in the Southwest, and there's sea level rise along the coast, and, you know, there's a string of tornadoes, you know, so it, you have to start imagining that it will impact the American economy pretty significantly, very significantly. Now, when you, as you say, obviously, if you're living, the closer you're living to the edge, you know, the easier it is to fall off the edge. And many people would argue, many experts would argue, we are already seeing, you know, huge flows of migrants from Central America north, from the Middle East and Africa north into Europe, that there is a climate component to that, that as people, you know, who are subsistence farmers or have more and more trouble, some people would argue there's a climate component to the Syrian civil war. So, yeah, there's going to be, you know, the estimates of people who are going to be on the move owing to climate change, you know, runs into the hundreds of millions of people in not that distant a future.
That's potentially extremely disruptive to global stability, global order, the security of nations around the world.
I mean, I think we're already seeing some of that now. As you said, there is a climate component to a lot of the migration.
Yeah, no, I was meeting with some students this morning. They said, like, what worries you the most? And I think that when you add, you know, the physical effects, you know, the effects on agriculture, the effects on, you know, just on the economy, and you add to that, you know, how humans tend to react to refugees, and you can see we're not reacting that well right now. Mm-hmm. You can see that it's sort of a potential recipe for a very destabilized world, and how, I don't know how that plays out.
So one of the central themes of your writing seems to be sort of the role of humanity in these massive events. You won the Pulitzer Prize for your book, The Sixth Extinction. What are the first five, and what's the sixth?
Okay, so the first five, the one everyone's familiar with, is the fifth, which ended the Cretaceous period about 66 million years ago, and it did in the dinosaurs, and it didn't just do in the dinosaurs. The dinosaurs are the ones we, and the dinosaurs, I should say, were a huge group of creatures. It did in a lot of very large groups of organisms, you know, the pterosaurs, all sorts of creatures that we no longer see. And it did in a lot of the mammals. You know, the mammals that exist today are obviously the descendants of mammals that made it through that extinction event. But there are lots of other kinds of mammals that did not, and birds that did not make it through that event. So that is the fifth extinction. And there's a pretty broad consensus these days that it was caused by an asteroid impact. The earlier ones go, you know, back, obviously, in the geological record. And the sixth, the idea of the sixth, which, you know, is certainly not my idea. It's an idea of, you will read it very commonly in the scientific literature now, the current mass extinction event, is that we are now, you know, extinction rates are so high, they're very high now, hundreds or perhaps thousands of times higher than they are during sort of normal geological times, that we are either on the verge of, or even some would say in the midst of, another mass extinction event where
the asteroid caused this event 66 million years ago. The consensus now is that it's humans. Humans are responsible for this killing off of species across the planet at unprecedented rates.
Yes, absolutely. And even, you know, in some cases, we are responsible because we were actively, you know, killing the species in question. You know, rhinos are in terrible trouble because they're getting poached. Elephants are in terrible trouble because they're also being poached, things like that. You know, we're overfishing, all of the things people sort of know about. And then indirectly, most extinctions are caused indirectly because either humans are mowing down the rainforest and planting soy, which is obviously, you know, not conducive to a lot of creatures that depended on that rainforest. Or we are moving things around the world. We've moved a lot of diseases around the world. We've moved a lot of predators around the world. And when you bring together, you know, these evolutionary lineages that have been separated across continents, different oceans, you often get some really, really nasty surprises. We are seeing this, you know, right now, for example, here in New England, with the emerald ash borer, which is going to devastate our ash trees in New England, a very, very important species in our New England forests. And this was an insect that was brought over from Asia and is having a field day, has no, you know, natural predators, that sort of thing. So we see that over and over again.
And you make the point in your book that we are the only species that carries, intentionally or unintentionally, other species, large to small to microbe, around the world.
Right, I mean,
we're the first and only.
Yeah, just think about it. I mean, obviously things have moved around the world. For example, you know, Hawaii has, you know, birds and insects and species that, and Hawaii is very isolated, right? It's basically in the middle of the ocean. So things do move around the world. Something had to colonize Hawaii, which, you know, arose from the ocean several million years ago, depending on the island. So things do move around the world, but they do it really rarely, right? It's really, really rare and hard, and people can't even figure out, you know, how did some of those species ever get to Hawaii? But when we get on a plane or we pack a cargo boat, right, in one part of the world, I quote a figure in the book that there are 10,000 species a day on the move in the ballast water of our tankers. Right.
So say that again.
10,000 species.
Yeah. So a ship, you know, will take on ballast water in one ocean, yeah, and dump it in another ocean, or in one waterway and dump it in another waterway, and it will move. A lot of these species are in microscopic. Some of them are not microscopic. And I'll give you another really good example of a problem that we have here in New England and throughout the U.S. The zebra mussel was brought over, you know, probably in tankers from Europe, Eastern Europe, and is now everywhere, just absolutely everywhere in the U.S. and is a huge, huge problem.
So, you know, apart from sort of disrupting sort of like what we might order at a seafood restaurant, why should humanity care about these species? You, in the sixth extinction, you talk about, toads, and you talk about animals that have been extinct for centuries and penguins. Why should humanity care about these invasive species and these other species that are facing extinction?
Well, I think there are two ways to answer that question, and I'll give you both. And the first one is, you know, if the world that we inherited, the diversity of life on Earth, which, you know, was very high, we're at sort of a peak of diversity on Earth. All of the wondrous, you know, creatures of creation, big and small. Why if you don't care about that, life itself, we were really talking about the fabric of life itself, you know, it's, what do you care about? You know, that seems to me a pretty high bar. we are really talking about life. So life on Earth. So that, I think, on some level answers itself. We should care about it because, we are living creatures and we have a relationship to all living things. And even if we don't, you know, feel the tug of an insect or a toad, we are all part of the vast evolutionary story of life on Earth. And no particular species, when you think about it from a moral standpoint, you know, really has much of a right over other species, in my view. Okay, so that's one answer. And another more practical answer, if you say, well, okay, you know, put aside, the history of life, you know, put aside morality, just what does it mean to me personally sitting here wherever you are, then I think the question becomes, you know, at what point do these changes, how much of the fabric of life can you unravel before people who, like it or not, are still very much dependent on the biosphere, everything, you know, we eat, all the air we breathe is biologically produced. How much of that can you unravel before you really start to tinker with systems that you really wish you hadn't tinkered with and things get pretty ugly?
We've got about 30 seconds left here, but I'm thinking like bees?
Bees. Pollinators, for example. If you mess around with your pollinators, all plants have to be pollinated. So you're really messing around with the very, very fundamentals of the world as we know it.
In like 10 seconds, people listening or watching this, what would you advise them to do that care about these issues?
Well, I advise people I think the most important thing people can do is make their voices heard politically, you know, and bring these issues to the top of the political agenda, because there are unfortunately issues, fortunately or unfortunately, that have to be solved on a very grand scale.
It's a great place to
thank
leave
you.
It.
Yeah.
Elizabeth Colbert, thank you so much for being with us. Congratulations on all your success. She's Elizabeth Colbert. The book is The Sixth Extinction, and she's the 2019 Pell Center Prize winner. That's all the time we have this week, but if you want to know more about Story in the Public Square, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter or visit pellcenter.org, where you can also catch up on previous episodes. He's G. Wayne Miller. I'm Jim Lutis, asking you to join us again next time for more Story in the Public Square.
Just going to run this dog to see if we can find any type of human remains that are left.
Listen to Where Secrets Go to Die, The Disappearance of Derek Hennigan. From the Detroit Free Press, a new podcast set in the woods of Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Available on Apple, Spotify, Freep.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.